Please welcome our first speaker of the morning, Emmanuel Bloch, who will tell us about how to probe and control quantum matter. Emmanuel.
Okay, so welcome everybody. Thanks a lot for having me here. And as an experimentalist, telling you my view on quantum matter. So, I mean, quantum matter is of course a huge field. Subir is going to give you a completely different view on that. Well, maybe not completely different, but what I'm going to focus on today is kind of what we can do with cold atoms in the field of quantum matter and what kind of the new probing techniques allow us to do and why these systems are really special. And I think they're actually a very good choice for convergence for this meeting because they really bring together a lot of different fields. You know, I'm an atomic physicist, quantum optician, but I've been dealing with things like quantum field theories, Higgs particles, quantum magnetism and things like that. So let me go through what I would like to talk about today. After giving you a brief introduction, you know, what we can do in these systems and why we're doing it, I'd like to talk about a few systems where I think a lot of progress has been made, and I'd like to give you a perspective where I think progress is going to be going in the next years, and what are the exciting things we can discover in these fields. So we'll start with many-body physics with cold atoms, then talking about something like artificial gate field and geometric band properties that are now, of course, important in the context also of topological effects. And I think one really big thing where cold atoms are really unique is non-equilibrium physics. And that's, of course, something that connects to many of you, many of the work you're doing here. And finally, actually, something I don't have on this outline slide is to give you also a view on some of the applications in metrology. So what do we build on? So our starting point is basically taking these super controlled systems like single atoms or ions, or now also solar, you think about like a quantum dot, a single quantum system, and you build that together to build like an artificial quantum material in the spirit very much of Richard Feynman's vision of a quantum simulator to study this, to study physical systems that are really hard to compute on classical computers. So we're taking these highly controllable systems and trying to assemble quantum matter out of that, and I'd like to give you several examples of where this quantum matter, this artificial synthetic quantum matter, can have applications and what new kind of tools we have to probe them and to analyze them. So why are we doing this? Well, of course, there's the fundamental aspects of many phenomena that we don't really understand so well and that we'd like to learn more about, ranging from high TC, magnetism, novel quantum sensors, maybe in applications, down to applications in metrology, which I'll come back to in the end of my talk, when we think about measuring time. You know, the best ways of measuring time are actually now built with these cold atoms in optical lattices. So my point of focus today, for the most part, will be on these fundamental aspects of many-body systems, trying to understand them and trying to introduce to you what new aspects we have to look at them. So our starting points are ultra-cold quantum gases. So we start either very simply with bosons, for example, rubidium-87 isotope, or if we want to choose a fermion, we take a fermionic isotope, potassium-40, and we try to make them as cold as possible in very simple traps. And the simplest traps we all know are just harmonic oscillators. So we just build traps, magnetic traps, optical traps, and make these systems as cold as we can. And these, of course, by themselves are not so interesting quantum systems to study. And then we try to convert them into something more interesting, something strongly interacting, and probe this. And so here's kind of what this looks like in the experiment. So you typically, all of this is done in ultra-high vacuum chambers at nanokelvin temperatures. So we need a very good vacuum. We have these glass cells where we have this vacuum inside. And behind this glass cell wall, I mean, that's always amazing for me to remind myself, you have temperatures of around a few nanokelvin, the gas clouds floating in this kind of glass cell here, and this outside wall is completely room temperature. So there's no cryogenic cooling, no nothing, liquid nitrogen, liquid, you know, helium or something going on here. All this is room temperature, but nevertheless, behind this glass cell wall sits a tiny atom cloud at a few nanokelvin temperatures. So that's really amazing to have this. And what this buys you is that you're also not connected to any thermal reservoir. And that's very different from a kind of experiment in condensed matter where people would take their material probe, hook it up, and cool it down in a thermostat, or cryostat, And, you know, then you're always connected to a thermal reservoir. So you're intrinsically always connected to a temperature bath, a heat bath. Whereas here we can really study the physics, and I'll come back to that point, of isolated quantum systems and ask fundamental questions that go back for even to points like, how does temperature actually emerge in such isolated quantum systems? How does that concept of temperature even come about? So that's very unique. And then, of course, there's the reality in the labs of these hundreds of mirrors and lasers and things we need to do these experiments. These are all tabletop experiments, so they're typically done in teams of 4 to 5 people. But they are complex experiments, as you can see. And you know, when we bring students to have a tour through our labs, they usually think this is the storage room for our optics. But I warn them, you know, if you touch a single mirror on this table, the whole experiment is not going to work anymore. So please don't do that. And you need good graduate students, you know, to make this, to align this, to make this work, and in case something's going wrong, to find the error on this. So how do we make these crystal structures? So for us, we work with optical lattices. So we create the crystals completely artificially through optical interference. So we take two laser beams, interfere them, which gives us a standing wave, and for example, typically spacing of 0.5 micron, if we take typical optical wavelengths. And by Fourier synthesis, you can basically synthesize any optical lattice you can think of, any crystal structure you can think of. So let me give you a few beautiful examples. So these were actually taken by Ted Hensch in his own private labs in Munich, where he did a beautiful demonstration experiment. So what he did was to take a laser beam, take a big laser beam, expand it through this, over this, cover this aperture, and then punch some holes in here, so let's say two holes, and then put a lens behind this aperture and then focus down the light that goes through those kind of apertures. And here, of course, you see if you have two holes, you just have two beams passing, you interfere them, you just get two beam interference, you get this beautiful optical standing wave that you can see here taken, recorded directly on the screen. Now, if you take three beams, you see you get this beautiful triangular hexagonal pattern. Now you have line of hexagonal lattice structure, triangular lattice structure. If you take five beams, you get this beautiful quasi-crystal structure. Or if you take another one more, you add to that. And I mean, just, you know, just the sheer beauty of these objects, they're just beautiful by themselves. I mean, this is no Mathematica plot or anything. You know, this is just optical interference of these few laser beams passing through this aperture. And so far, people haven't really looked at studying what happens in these quasi-crystals. We're studying kind of more kind of normal crystal structures. But this is the landscape the atoms move in our experiments. So it's an optical landscape created by us artificially on top of the atoms. In addition to that, we can also tune the interactions between the particles. So we have the possibility through so-called scattering resonances, Feshbach resonances, to change the interaction strength between those ultra-cold atoms at the knob of a magnetic field. So you can start out, for example, with having attractive interactions here or in this region when the scattering length is negative. You can have strongly repulsive interactions when the scattering length is large and positive. Or you can really study the physics of an ideal gas if you want to, not so interesting, but if you want to, you can go to this non-interacting point here. And again, because it's at the control of a magnetic field, we can change this dynamically. We can change the lattices and the interactions we can change dynamically in these systems. Now, how come we can study the physics of real materials or kind of in these gases? And I failed to say these gases are extremely dilute. At the most, the densest gases we're studying, they're like 5 orders of magnitude even diluter than the air surrounding us in this room. So we're really talking about extremely dilute systems, and how come we can study, you know, kind of strong correlation effects, for example, in this? Well, the point is, of course, that the only thing that matters for a many-body system is the ratio of de Broglie wavelength to interparticle distance. And in our experiments, what we do is, rather than building a very good microscope to look into a real material, we try to scale up the material by a factor of 10,000 and thereby use optical techniques to look into this kind of artificial synthetic quantum material. But then, of course, if we'd scale up d by a factor of 10,000 compared to normal crystal, then, of course, we need to scale up lambda by another factor of 10,000 as well. And that means, of course, we need to go to ultra-cold temperatures to bring these systems into a quantum degenerate regime. But if you do that, then indeed you can study the physics of strongly correlated materials, which typically happens at 10 orders of magnitude larger densities in these extremely dilute systems. There's another thing that spies you. All the time evolution, the time scales at which things happen slow down dramatically too. So everything that happens in a solid at femtosecond, attosecond timescales, and our crystal materials, because they're so scaled up, the energy scales have become so much lower, all this now happens at a millisecond timescale. So you can look at the real-time evolution at very convenient timescales of these quantum systems. Okay, so that's the essential goal. That's essentially what we do. And the price, of course, we always have to pay with this is to make this de Broglie wavelength big, so we have to cool the particles to very, very low temperatures in the nanoKelvin regime to make this happen. Now, let me turn to another point where I think really cold atoms provide a unique view into these quantum materials, something we haven't really, I think, understood to exploit completely to its full power yet. And let me remind you again, when you have a single particle in a wave function here and you measure it, and then, of course, you can find, for example, this if you have a Gaussian wave function here, you would find a single particle randomly in each snapshot you make of that system. And only when you repeat the experiment many, many times, you get kind of the full distribution function of that particle in position space. And that is, of course, much more, knowing much more about the particle than just knowing the average position, the average momentum of the particle. And what we used to do only for single particles, we can now also do for many particles, for many body system. And that's really amazing, because think of a material, let's say a fractional quantum Hall state, a complex correlated material, where you would take a photo of the electrons in that material and you could see each individual electron in that material. Okay? So we can't do that for large systems, but essentially for mesoscopic systems, this is what we have learned over the past years to do in experiments in Harvard and Markus Greiner's group and in our team in Munich. So let me give you an idea what it means to do that. So imagine you have your many-body wave function, and it's some complex coherent superposition of different spatial configurations of those atoms, spins, whatever they are in the system. Okay? And all the correlations are hidden, for example, in this complex superposition pattern that we have here. When we do a measurement, a local measurement, with high resolution on those atoms to find their position, we collapse the wave function onto one of those superposition states. Okay? Which one we don't know, we just collapse onto one of those, and that's the spatial configuration we see in that single snapshot of the experiment. If we repeat the experiment again after preparing the same psi, it will collapse onto something else that you can see here, we don't know. But having access to these single snapshots not only gives you kind of the local average position of the particle, but it allows you also to calculate all kind of position correlations between particles. So how is this particle correlated with this one, and this one over here? And in many of these correlated materials, this is, of course, what characterizes them, all these intricate correlation effects between those particles. So we have ideas to extend this not only to position measurements, but how you could do this, for example, also for currents. So you could measure currents locally and correlate kind of correlation functions, full distribution functions for those currents in those materials. So here's how this works. So we basically have built a very good microscope objective. Remember, our lattice scales are on the micrometer length scale, so we can look into those lattices optically. And we basically create these kind of interesting materials here, for example, and then we illuminate them with near-resonant light, so the atoms start to fluoresce, and we capture the fluorescence with these very good microscope objectives. And here's what this looks like. Here's a snapshot of this, such an image that we can take, in this case of a thermal gas, so it's not so interesting, but suffices to show you what we can do. And each bright spot that you can see here is a single atom held in this crystal of light, okay, in this vacuum chamber. Okay? And you can see we can see these atoms with extraordinary good signal-to-noise ratio, so we can clearly tell on which lattice site there is an atom, on which site there is no atom present in this system. And with that, we can analyze kind of fundamental transitions between different phases of matter. I'll come back to this, for example, here between a Bose-Einstein condensate for bosons, where you have large particle number fluctuations that you can see here directly recorded from this image. And when we make the interactions very strong between the system, we see that these particle number fluctuations are suppressed and we enter this phase of what we call a mod insulator, where we have, for example, exactly one atom per lattice site. Now, one thing I want to draw your attention to is sometimes there seem to be things going wrong, so there seem to be defects here. And these defects are actually individual thermal fluctuations of the system. Because we're not at absolute zero temperature, we have residual entropy in the system, and this residual entropy manifests itself as kind of these fluctuations that we have here in the system, these defects that you can see here. So by just counting the number of defects I have in the system, I can actually measure the temperature of the system. So it's completely doing measuring temperature in a very new way by really counting individual excitations of your system. And doing that, I could, for example, tell you that this gas has a temperature down, let's say, to a few tens of picokelvin temperature. We can measure the temperature of this by just counting these number of fluctuations we have. We can not only image thermal fluctuations, but just to give you an idea, we can also measure quantum fluctuations of this many-body system. So typically, we envisage this mod insulating state not as something static, but something that has a lot of flickering of kind of particle movement on top of it. And these quantum fluctuations that occur even at zero temperature, we can make direct snapshots of. So we can measure the thermal quantum fluctuations and the propagation, for example, of such quantum fluctuations in these quantum many-body systems. Now, moving on from observation, let me tell you a little bit about how we can control actually particles now in these lattice structures. So if you have a good microscope objective to resolve different lattice sites, then you can also focus down a laser beam in reverse through the objective and send it onto a lattice beam and control individual atoms. So for example, you could tell me, go to atom number 4355 and rotate the spin of that atom into a certain direction. And then release that spin impurity in the system and let it propagate and see what happens, for example. And so here's how we do that. Here are some examples that we can do that. We can really take this laser beam, focus it on our atomic systems, and here you can see a square of 6 by 6 atoms. Here are 12 atoms in a row. Here's actually a nail, classical antiferromagnetic structure created artificially by flipping every second atom. Here's a star, and well, as quantum physicists, we like to make a psi out of 26 individual atoms in the system. And we can do that with resolutions down to 50 nanometers, much better than the optical resolution, and thereby clearly, you know, select individual lattice sites and control the spins of the atoms on these individual lattice sites. Now, one step we're moving further on in controlling these systems is not, you know, just focusing single laser beams and controlling atoms one by one, but rather making use of this high controllability in a parallel way. So here's kind of a digital mirror device. This is actually the same thing that's controlling the projector behind me, that's projecting the light of my slides onto the screen here. And we use these mirror devices to basically create arbitrary light structures. So we can send a beam of light, laser light, onto this digital mirror device, and out we get a line of light or an exotic lattice structure or something where you have two reservoirs connected by a thin wire of light conducting, which you can conduct atoms through one by one. Or if you don't want harmonic traps that I talked about, you like square potentials better, you just make this square box potential even. So we're trying to make lattice structures now, and in general, optical potentials with qualities that will allow us to basically project arbitrary light structures onto your atoms and realize arbitrary lattice structures or potential structures you want, okay? Just by controlling the light field, by shaping the light field and projecting it onto the atoms. Okay, so let me move on and give you a little bit of the status of where things stand today in cold atom research and where I think we hope can see progress in the next years in this field. So let me start with this field of the so-called Hubbard models, where we basically just have very simple lattices, we have hopping between lattice sites, we have just on-site interactions. So that's actually something in a solid you could worry about with the Coulomb interactions. For our cold atoms, they're actually very, very goodly modeled by these local interactions because they're neutral. They only interact at short range through van der Waals interaction. So whenever they come together on one of those lattice sites, they interact. If they're kind of separate on separate sites, they don't interact. So this kind of model of an on-site interaction is actually very good fulfilled. So you have the hopping, you have the interaction, and then you have maybe some external potentials, a harmonic trap, or a box in which these atoms move. So this problem has been looked at a lot with bosons, fermions, and so forth. So let me give you a little bit of update where we stand. So on the bosonic problem, there's actually a very famous phase transition between Bose-Einstein condensate and the mod insulator we talked about. We saw the pictures before already in my talk. Whenever you make the interactions between the bosons strong compared to their kinetic energy. So whenever you have weak interactions, you have the superfluid state where you have a Bose-Einstein condensate with its macroscopic wave function. When you release it from the optical crystal, it kind of diffracts, it interferes, the matter waves interfere from this Bose-Einstein condensate and give you this beautiful interference pattern. So this is exactly the interference pattern you know from light diffracting off a material grating, but now the roles of light and matter are just reversed in this case, right? And in this case, you also have a lot of particle number fluctuations because we know that the underlying states, the many-body states, are just Glauber coherent states, so they have a lot of particle number fluctuations, and the only thing we can tell, actually, is that they have this Poissonian particle number distribution if we go in and measure. And if you remember my picture I showed you before in the quantum gas microscope, you could remember these kind of large quantum fluctuations that you have in the occupation space. When you make the interaction strong, you see that these kind of particle number fluctuations are strongly suppressed, and you basically enter into this regime of exactly one particle per site, and also that we could measure. You see in this case the interference pattern completely vanishes because the quantum fluctuations in the phase become so large that any interference of those waves is kind of scrambled because of the random phases that interfere now with each other. But now you've traded that off for kind of order in the particle number space that you can see here, and I've also shown you images of that. So we can really see both sides of coherence and particle number fluctuations now in these experiments. And connecting these two phases is actually a quantum phase transition, where Subir and Bernard Kaimer wrote a very nice introductory article here in Physics Today, and I guess Subir is going to tell us much more about those quantum phase transitions in his talk. And we can study that a lot. And actually, one thing we studied at this quantum phase transition is actually something that intrigued me very much, is that you can study the physics, relativistic physics, quantum field theories at this quantum phase transition point. So it turns out at this quantum phase transition, the field of a Bose-Einstein condensate obeys relativistic dynamics and basically, in terms of a field theory, corresponds to a very simple relativistic quantum field theory you could write down, a scalar kind of U1 quantum field theory. And something that intrigued people a lot was whether this Higgs particle would actually exist also in a two-dimensional world. And there had been many publications on this. And when we did the experiments on this, we could indeed show that this Higgs particle does exist. We can see a clear resonance structure in this two-dimensional system. An academic question, if you want, but nevertheless shows that you can study, you know, this physics of usually vastly different energy scales, 24 orders of magnitude different energy scales, at these ultra-cold temperatures when you bring the system exactly to this point of a quantum phase transition. Yeah. So where do we stand? So we have this bosonic variant of the Hubbard model, the fermionic variant of the Hubbard model. There have been many, many experiments on that, on these mod insulators, studying quantum fluctuations, revealing hidden order, hidden correlation patterns, string order in these systems, doing spectroscopy on these systems. What we'd like to do is we'd like to really bring the system more into this quantum critical region, explore more the physics of this quantum critical region. And one way that we need to do, that's required in the experiments, is to remove this trap. To really see these diverging length scales at a quantum phase transition point, we really need homogeneous systems. But I think now with these box potentials that I showed you, we're in a good shape to do this in the future. So I see much more coming up in this respect in the future experiments that are just coming online now. So for the fermionic Hubbard model, there's been also a lot of studies. You might have heard, and maybe Subir will tell you more about that, in the Fermi-Hubbard model, that's one of the candidate models for high-TC superconductivity, or that at least contains some of the essential physics for high-TC. So far, our struggle has been to get to low enough temperatures in this system to really get the system to show, for example, anti-ferromagnetic orderings, and to then maybe search on for a possible D-wave superconducting phase in this Hubbard model. So what about quantum magnetism? So when we talk about quantum magnetism in these systems, there have also been many, many studies on this, starting from super exchange to spin impurity propagation. I'll show you an example in a second, where we actually make use of this local access, this local possibility to manipulate spins on the lattices. I've talked about the antiferromagnetism. One thing that's actually, I think, interesting that shows the potential of cold atoms to realize absolutely new system is that in a solid, you're always restricted with electrons to spin up and down, spin 1/2 particles, right? But when we make use of the large hyperfine spin that we can find in an atom,
you could have many, many more spin states than two just spin up and down. And we can have atoms where we can have, for example, 12 different spin states in the system. Yeah? And these kind of SUN extensions to these systems, I think also interesting, and people are starting to study these, where we're looking at fermions with kind of large number of spin flavors on the lattice and trying to see what kind of different magnetic orderings or strong correlation physics we're seeing there. So these experiments are just coming, starting, and some very interesting results have been achieved there already. Now, there are other mappings of achieving super quantum magnetism rather than the simple super exchange coming from the Hubbard model that people have been exploring. I'll talk about that in a second, mainly based on longer range interactions that would allow us to access kind of more exotic spin models and thereby also maybe more exotic spin phases in those systems. And maybe together with, like, you know, Kagome lattice structures, look at kind of interesting exotic spin phases there. Although I have to caution a bit, one thing that worries me there is very often all those phases occur at extremely low temperatures. A lot of the spin liquid phases people have been talking about occur at extremely low temperatures, and that might not be our strongest point in achieving those low temperatures. But we'll have to see, I guess, how the cooling proceeds and how low entropies we can get in these systems. One example I want to show you of how this manipulation really turned out beautifully in quantum magnetism is that we could really see for the first time directly in the material the elementary bound magnon states that were predicted by Bethe in 1931 when he was a postdoc with Enrico Fermi in Rome. So what Bethe was studying was just a simple Heisenberg chain, and he was asking, you know, what happens? He actually found that the theory of Felix Bloch overcounted the number of solutions, didn't get the number of solutions correctly, and he found that Bloch was missing kind of an excitation branch, those of those kind of bound magnons. So what you can think of them is as whenever there are two spins close together, next to each other, they can attract each other and they stick together and form a new quasiparticle in the system, the bound magnon that now propagates as a new quasiparticle through the system. Rather than these spins propagating independently, these two have to hop together if there's a strong ferromagnetic interaction between them. And what we could show in this experiment, we could directly, you know, flip two spins. The experiment for us is very direct. We make the spin chain, we flip two spins, and just look how they propagate through the system. Okay? And then we could really see how they're sticking together, how they're moving in a correlated fashion through this quantum material, and we could measure kind of the propagation speed, the excitation branch of these bound magnons in the system. So let me turn to kind of a new field where we're trying to extend the range of cold atoms to kind of more longer range interacting quantum systems. So here's kind of what people are trying to do. So rather than just relying on these short range van der Waals interactions between the atoms, we're trying to use atoms that either have a strong dipolar moment, or I should say molecules, for example, where you can have a strong polar dipole attached to them, or you can go, for example, to Rydberg atoms. So you take your rubidium atom, you excite it to a very highly excited principal quantum number state where the electron is very loosely bound to the atomic core. And in that case, because the electron is so loosely bound, you get a hugely enhanced van der Waals interaction. It's actually so dramatic, I don't know if you know this, this scales like with the 11th power of the principal quantum number, the van der Waals interaction between two atoms. So when you excite them, you know, from 5s, to 43s, for example, in the principal quantum number, you get a dramatic enhancement in the interaction strengths between those atoms. And so we're trying to make use of these kind of more long-range interactions and kind of admix it in a controlled way to our ground state atoms to hopefully also look for supersolids where we have kind of coexistence of the superfluid and crystalline order in the system formed by self-organization in the system through these kind of long-range interactions. You might have heard there was this long story in helium where people had felt they had discovered supersolids in liquid helium, but again found in the end that was not true. So this is still open, something we haven't really realized in experiments, but we know actually from theory it should be there, especially with the interactions we can generate, for example, through these Rydberg atoms. There's also cavity systems I'm not going to talk about very much, where you can have very long-range interactions, where you can put atoms in an optical cavity, and through the light field in the cavity, each atom talks to each other atom in the system. So you have basically infinite range interactions in these systems mediated by the interactions by the cavity between the atoms in this system. here's just an image of what this Rydberg things that I talked about before, these Rydberg atoms. When we try to excite from, let's say, hundreds of atoms, we try to excite these to the excited state, because of this very strong repulsive interaction between the particles, you see that they form these crystalline structures. So these are direct images of Rydberg atoms, spatially resolved, and you can see how, because of the interaction between the particles, they form these crystalline structure. Yeah? So you can think of this as a long-range quantum Ising model, where these are kind of the ground states of this long-range quantum Ising model. Actually, we think that this is not just this one spatial configuration, but this is rather a quantum crystal in the following sense, that we've created actually a superposition state of this crystalline configuration and all other rotationally invariant crystalline configurations in the system as well. So you could think of this not as a classical Wigner crystal, but something that really has this kind of quantum superposition between those different spatial configurations that you can see here. Finally, let me come to a field of artificial gauge fields that has been very prominently going on in the past years. And the idea is, of course, to try to explore the physics of charged particles in the magnetic field, which has been so successful in the realm of condensed matter physics. Now, here's a real problem, of course, because our atoms are neutral. And when you apply a magnetic field, the only thing you see is Zeeman kind of spin magnetism and no orbital magnetism, right? So how can we do something like orbital magnetism with cold atoms, with neutral particles? Well, one thing people thought about early on, and still worthwhile of thinking about again, I think, is that when you start to rotate these quantum gases, the Coriolis force can play the role of the Lorentz force. So you actually see that the Lorentz force has exactly the same structure as this Coriolis force. So by setting the gas in rotation, you can mimic the physics of a charged particle in a magnetic field. And this has been very successfully used by different groups in Paris, Jean Dalibard's group, Wolfgang Kedeler's group at MIT, to set these gases in rotation and actually introduce vortices in these quantum gases. Another way to do that, to mimic the effect of charged particle in a magnetic field, is to mimic the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So you know, the essential thing that goes on for a charged particle in a magnetic field is when you move around a region with the magnetic flux enclosed, you pick up a phase shift. That's essentially what you need to simulate. If you can simulate that, then you've simulated the physics of a charged particle in a magnetic field. So if you can find different ways to do that, then you can also introduce these vortices, and this you can also do, for example, by laser-induced propagation or laser-induced hopping of those particles that was kind of, for example, shown here in the group of Ian Spielman at NIST, where he also created these vortices by simulating these Aronoff-Bohm phase shifts. So far, the fields have been low, and we've been trying to work on a new method in lattices that allows us to generate basically arbitrary fluxes. So what you need to simulate in this model, again, I show you here, you have this particle, when it hops around one plaquette, it's supposed to pick up a phase shift. And when it picks up a phase shift, that's like the Aronoff-Bohm phase for a charged particle in the magnetic field. And what we do in our lattices, we engineer them in such a way that when a particle hops from here to here, it picks up a different phase than when it hops from here to here. And thereby, we're going around a loop, you pick up a phase difference of phi 1 minus phi 2, which you can adjust with your laser beams, and you can basically introduce arbitrary fluxes in this model. So you can have anything from 0 to pi flux piercing through this square lattice in the system. And that's a big deal, because the fluxes that you can realize in this way would correspond to several thousands of Tesla that you would have to apply to a real material with normal lattice spacing, unless you also kind of lose super lattices, to realize such extremely large fluxes. So it probably gives us a chance to explore the physics of strong correlated materials, hopefully, in very, very strong fields, which is basically, I think, pretty much uncharted territory. When you have this kind of artificial fields and you look at the band structures you generate in this way, they are very often of topological nature. They have geometric features in these bands. And one way to reveal that is, again, to build an interferometer. And because we can move atoms so well around, we can control them so well, not only in real space, but also in momentum space in the Brillouin zone of all atoms, we're able to build an interferometer which directly mimics kind of an Aronoff-Bohm interferometer in real space, where you would typically take an electron, move it around kind of a magnetic flux region, interfere the electrons to read out kind of through the interference pattern the flux that you have inside. And now what we've been able to do with our colleagues Dimar Banin and Eugene Demmler was to realize such an interferometer in reciprocal space, in crystal momentum space, where, for example, you take the special case of a Dirac cone in graphene, where you have a delta function concentrated pi flux at the Dirac cone, so it's something you cannot measure in transport directly, and by moving the particles around this region in the same way in reciprocal space, we can reveal kind of this kind of pi phase shift of this Dirac cone. We can reveal the geometric properties of the bands through these novel interferometers that we can realize. And we're just working on this to extend this to multiband configurations where concepts like Wilson lines, Wilson loops, that some of you know more from quantum field theories, play actually an important role in characterizing these multiple band structures. Okay, so in the lattice, in this kind of artificial gauge field systems, there's again a lot been done already. Most of the stuff has been single particle physics, because the way we generate the artificial gauge fields is typically through kind of dynamical effects, through non-equilibrium driven quantum systems. And we still have to understand, well, how in these driven quantum systems, how interactions between particles affect heating, lead to heating effects in the system, undesirable heating effects. And I think that's something we need to get better under control. And hopefully, and when people are just starting to look at this, which is an interesting problem by itself, and hopefully once we can settle that question, we have a good chance of adding on top of that the interaction effects in the system. Okay, so finally, how much time do I have left, actually? 5 minutes? Okay, perfect. So let me come to the possibilities of non-equilibrium dynamics. So we already talked in the beginning, I told you that ultracold atoms offer a unique ability to study non-equilibrium dynamics because they are isolated from the rest of the world. Well, that's not completely true, of course. They will thermalize with black body radiation. You know, you might wonder, we're in a thermal environment, there's black body radiation, it will thermalize our atoms. But it will take extremely long because atoms have very few resonance lines. This thermalization process can take extremely long. So for all purposes, our atoms are very well disconnected from any environment, and we can study the questions connected to non-equilibrium dynamics in these closed quantum systems. So one thing people have started to look at a lot is what goes under the title of quantum quenches. So you take your quantum system, you rapidly change some parameter, let's say a lattice depth, interaction strength, some magnetization locally, and see how this system reacts to that. Okay? And you do that in a way that's far away from equilibrium, from the equilibrium properties, for example. And that's really pretty much open territory. Also, in terms of theory, there's very little methods that can handle this efficiently. In 1D, we have DMRG, matrix product states, that can do short-time evolution, but I'm always frustrated as an experimentalist that they can't go a bit further to compare with experiments. If you go to higher dimensions, there's basically nothing out there that you can use to predict this non-equilibrium dynamics. Okay, so it's really unexplored territory where we desperately need improvements in theory to help us explain the phenomena. Connected to that is the very important question of when does an isolated system actually thermalize? So you take an isolated quantum system in a very highly excited state, let's say it's a pure state of the many-body system, and you ask, when it's disconnected from any thermal reservoir, how does temperature emerge in this isolated quantum system? It turns out we know now through the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis that for most Hamiltonians, if you look for local observables, this happens in these because the quantum degrees of freedom are rapidly diluted between the many, many degrees of freedom the many-body system shows in this context. But there are systems we know now today where this completely fails, where this thermalization fails, and thereby we cannot use at all our statistical physics kind of approach to describe them. One kind of very prominent example of that is the so-called phenomena of many-body localization, which I just want to tell you about in a second here, where you really have the distinction between a system on the one hand, which would thermalize the normal behavior, so you prepare your system, well, that's not a quantum system, but it tries to represent the quantum system, your coffee with your milk on top, and you know, because this boundary here, you know, rapidly dilutes in the system, your quantum information is rapidly diluted over the degrees of freedom, and very often then we can use a hydrodynamic effective description to describe such a many-body system. Now, that's usually what happens, and you can use kind of classical statistical physics, hydrodynamics to describe these systems. But we now have a class of systems, so-called many-body localized systems where such quantum information can persist forever in the system. This typically happens in disordered systems. People are trying to find systems that are not disordered where this could happen, but I think it's fair to say that's not been found so far. So typically in disordered, strongly interacting systems, you can now have a situation where you can have this insulating behavior, where this quantum information does not propagate, where thermalization hypothesis completely fails, and thereby our whole approach of statistical physics, hydrodynamics, all fails in describing these quantum systems. And it's very exciting to kind of ask what is the nature of the phase transition between this kind of classical world regime and this quantum world regime over here. And I think now we're starting to connect experiments to theory and asking many of the questions that are relevant in trying to kind of identify the boundary between those two regions and the phase transitions maybe that connect these two regions. Because they're not ground state phase transitions, they're really phase transitions in excited states of the system, highly excited states of the system, where we really don't know very much about. Actually, if you want to read a good introduction to that, I like this article from Raoul Nankishore and David Hughes on this many-body localization and thermalization in quantum statistical mechanics. So finally, let me skip the negative temperatures. Let me show you something practical. I mean, we talked about all fundamental issues, but something where optical lattices, I think, soon are going to impact all of our lives. You might not have thought about that. What are these lattices doing? But if you think about clocks, some of the best clocks today are built using ultra-cold atoms in lattices. So there's a work of my colleague Junier in Boulder, who traps individual atoms in this optical lattices, as we've seen. And because the atoms are isolated from each other, there are no collisions between those atoms. If you set an atom into oscillation on a single lattice site, it can oscillate for a long, long time without being disturbed by any other atom. There are no collisional broadening effects, nothing that disturbs that atom sitting on that lattice. And so today, the best clocks we know are built in these optical lattices, and it's probably very soon that our standard of the second, based on kind of the cesium standard, is going to be replaced by such optical lattice clocks. Just to give you an idea how this has evolved over the recent years, this is basically where we stand today. I think they even improved on this. We're at a fractional frequency uncertainty of 10 to minus 18 level for the atomic clocks that you make. These are really amazing clocks if you think of their uncertainty. These are clocks that have an uncertainty of about 1 second over the entire lifetime of our universe. Okay? These are clocks where you have to worry whether you run them on the table down here on the floor or whether you put them on a table because of the gravitational redshift. Okay? These are clocks that are so sensitive to so many effects that I think will be can be very useful for precision physics, for many things that we want to look at, variation of fundamental constants and other things in the future. And all this is happening in these optical lattices. And I think soon these are going to replace our standard clocks. So whenever you do some navigation or something, at some point you might rely on ultra-cold atoms in optical lattices. So let me just close with this outlook. I've tried to give you in this short presentation overlook of all the things, you know, the fundamental science of different fields we're trying to bring together with cold atoms. Hopefully, we can also at some point make connections to non-equilibrium effects in cosmology or high-energy physics. Well, actually, some applications I already showed you in high-energy physics. What we're trying to do right now is bring a lot of the individual technologies that were explored together, the microscope, with the artificial gauge fields, to make them, you know, used for search of new phases of matter and characterize these with the unique ways that are offered by these quantum gas microscopes. And all in all, I think one amazing thing in this field for me is it's been a beautiful testbed for theory. And close interaction between theory and experiment has been extremely useful over the past years and stimulating in promoting both theory and experiment. Okay, with that, I thank you very much for your attention.
I'm wondering, in your non-thermalizing systems, is there any relation between that and the Fermi-Pasta-Ulam nonlinear spring experiments that led to solitons, where they expected thermalization and it didn't happen.
This was in chaotic quantum systems.
This is in classical nonlinear springs, and they ran them and they noticed that the system did not thermalize, and then that led to the Kruskal-Szabowski discovery of solitons when they went to the continuum limit with the KdV equation, Korteweg-de Vries equation.
Okay, I don't know too much about it, so I'm not sure I can. I mean, so inherently, this is the problem here is a quantum problem. So I'm trying to make the connection here where there's a mapping maybe onto some classical problem here. Here it's really, it's a non-driven, we're talking about non-driven systems. So I think the pendulum is, that's the driven system you're talking about, no? If I understand correctly. That's a driven pendulum system or? Oh, that's just a revival, basically, of the revival. I mean, that, I guess, would happen for any finite size system, right? That you could have those revivals, I mean, occurring in the system. Maybe, yeah, Subi.
I think for integrable systems.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so, okay, if it's the question, okay, so integrable systems, so in quantum systems, we have the integrable systems where the same thing can happen, but these are usually fine-tuned systems. So you need to fine-tune the Hamiltonian to exactly lead to that behavior. So there are certain fine-tuned Hamiltonians where you can also have the failure of thermalization, but I think what's interesting here in the many-body localization case, this is absolutely nothing fine-tuned. This is a very robust thing. It doesn't depend on the details of your Hamiltonian. Okay, and actually, when we did the experiments on this, you could observe this for a wide variety of interaction strengths, different Hamiltonians, different energy densities of the initial state. So it's really a robust phenomenon. I think that makes it somewhat more general than the fine-tuning of your Hamiltonian, which, of course, in experiment, we're never going to be able to realize exactly that fine-tuned Hamiltonian, where you can have like a lot of okay, that I don't know. We should talk about that. That I don't know. But if it's the question about an integrable model, all these integrable models with a large number of conserved quantities, which leads to failure of thermalization, they're usually in the quantum regime, they're always fine-tuned Hamiltonians. So if you go a little bit away from that point, it immediately thermalizes. And that's not the case for these many-body localized systems.
Random lattice.
Yes.
Spatial lattice.
Yes, yes.
So it's kind of hard to imagine what effect that would have and how you would ever get that effect in fundamental physics, where somehow in space you have to impose randomness.
Right. Well, for us it's easy, right? I mean, just think of, we can project any kind of, with the microscopes, we can project any kind of disorder distribution you want onto the atoms.
Right.
And what we looked so far was quasi-periodic disorder in one-dimensional systems. But you could, that's actually an interesting question, what kind of disorder promotes many-body localization and whatnot? And actually, does many-body localization need disorder? I think that's also a question people are trying to look for systems which are translationally invariant, which show many-body localization. But I think that's unclear at this point. Typically, the examples people look at are disordered, very strongly interacting systems.
So we have time for one more question.
At the end of your last slide, you showed the strong interaction between you mentioned the strong collaboration between theory and experiments. Mm-hmm. So let me ask a general question that probably you've heard before. Is what do you think are the couple most noticeable, important discoveries maybe that have been made in this field, or where are the discoveries to be made?
You mean what are the most important discoveries?
Unanticipated results from that kind of work, or where do you think...
Unanticipated, I would really say the non-equilibrium dynamics has led to many kind of unexpected results, and also the things we're looking at right now. But there's basically no, because there's no theory out there. I mean, when we, for example, do this many-body disordered systems, we look at the real-time evolution of this Hubbard model in two dimensions. There is no theory that can tell us what's going to happen at those systems. I mean, there's some hand-waving arguments, what people expect it to be, but I think we totally lack a theory of what we're going to see. And so I think especially in the context of non-equilibrium, we have a pretty unique system, you know, where we can study, use all the apparatus of measuring with high resolution, measure correlation functions, higher order correlation functions, how non-local order parameters evolve in these systems, and I think that's very exciting. And of course, I hope that theory will, you know, in 1D, we always use 1D as a reference point. So sometimes we do experiments in 1D because just there we can compare to something. And then we do the experiment in 2D and then we're out on our own. And so I think there are many of those predictions. I think this is clearly one field where I'd say is unexpected and both, you know, things that have not been predicted at all.
So let's thank Emmanuel again.